Yes, you are. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. The John Curley, Sherry Elliker Show. Sherry out back on, I think, Monday. Greg Talman in for another day. Well, he's changed the words to this song. Maybe it's Kenny Rogers' song. He doesn't like the words.
I already forgot the lyrics to my revised version.
That's
so.
All right. Diving in again. All righty.
I have so many questions right now.
Who was that that said that?
Huh? I think it was Sherry, wasn't it?
It sounds like Sherry.
I have so many questions.
Maybe Sherry, not. You're not here right now, Sherry. You're not allowed to have questions. You're not here. This is according to MyNorthwest.com, so it's a good source, that this is a fake spring. We're not to be sort of lulled into this false sense of security that we should all be running around in shorts. Although there are those people that always wear shorts no matter what the weather is. The short guys, the guys that always wear shorts and flip-flops, even if it's like 50 degrees below zero out. So I'm sorry, excuse me. You don't like those people, huh?
I just kind of can't relate.
I became a sweats guy during COVID, I have to say. I'm sorry. Oh. It pains me to put on the jeans every time when I have to come into work.
Yeah, but there's also the people that if it's 30 degrees out and it's snowing, they still wear shorts with pride.
No, I don't like those people.
Yeah. Okay.
That's problematic. Okay, you guys want to hear my two cents on the weather?
Wait. You know, we don't have that many listeners. We just start throwing people willy-nilly overboard. So we don't want the people
maintain
that, like,
every last one of them.
Shorts under 40 degrees, people. God, we don't like them. And then you, Greg, really? You wear sweatpants and it's such an effort to put on jeans? I mean, what's wrong with you? Come on.
I have my preferences.
I don't even want to do the show anymore.
Shorts, right, people got no reason to live.
Yes, thank you. So the what do they say? This is going to be in the 70s over the weekend.
Oh, it's going to be beautiful.
A couple of records. Beautiful. Okay. And then is there more cold weather coming or more snow or something like that? It's just a pattern that every once in a while we get a little fake spring.
Fake spring. Next week, starting on Wednesday, it'll be in the 40s again and raining come Thursday.
But here's the deal. Before we start focusing on the downside here, before we've even tasted the beautiful weather this weekend,
Good point.
Savor this moment while we can. So I'm going to get philosophical this Friday, okay? Just right out the chute here, because I would actually be thinking a lot more clearly if I had my Adidas sweatpants on right now. But nevertheless, this tight, restrictive jeans and belt is going to have to suit me for today.
Go ahead.
Okay, so we're talking about the show, and you know, weather's nice, so everybody has to talk about the weather. But the first thing everybody focuses on is it's not going to last. Not gonna last. And I'm thinking, we haven't even seen the sunshine yet, and we're focusing on the negative. But I will say this. I think that is a completely normal and honest human reaction, John. It's notable to me that, again, before you've even tasted the good, we think about the bad. So, Philosophical Friday, here's my theory. Deep inside every human being, John, there is this longing for a permanent paradise. But at every turn in this life, we're disappointed. We can't even enjoy the heaven or the Elysium or the celestial city that we get in bits, whether it's a beautiful weekend ahead or a delicious meal or a transcendent song. It's all ephemeral, right? And for some reason, our brains immediately have to go to, however much I'm enjoying this, it's not going to last. Your take.
Well, first of all, the word utopia comes from the Greek word, I think, meaning never or non-existent.
Here we go.
People that are always searching for utopia. But I will see your philosophy and raise you one with the analogy of the antelope at the watering hole.
Ah.
There are no curious antelopes at the watering hole. And this goes back to some 50 million years ago, the reptilian brain. It was all the survival. That's all we needed was survival. So if you imagine a bunch of antelopes and one of them are all there drinking water, and then one looks up and does the look around, and then bolts. All the other ones bolt because that's the way their brain is designed, as ours is as well. The one going, well, hold on, folks. Let's not overreact to something. There's plenty of water here. I don't know where. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Running off. What are you guys in a hurry for? That's the one that's eaten. So there was no curiosity. We would hear a sound. You immediately assume it's the worst. You see your phone number, a phone appears, and it's your boss. You assume the worst. That is the monkey brain, the reptilian brain that is all about survival, and we have not been able to override that. We can later on with a whole bunch of other things you can do, but the primary response to everything is always to assume the worst. Because if you didn't, we as a species would have ceased to exist.
I see.
So there's a really fascinating article in the Wall Street Journal a number of years ago said that we have this monkey brain. We have this old, old prehistoric brain that is all about survival, assuming the worst. But then you want to try to bring in Buddha and Buddha's idea of like living in the moment, blowing out the eternal flame of passion and just living in this moment and not always thinking that this next thing is going to be worse. It's really hard to get those two things to balance, but you have to override the monkey brain, the brain that tells you it's bad news or this is going to end or, you know, this can't keep going much longer or horrible things are right around the corner. You're always assuming something bad is right around the corner because, well, that's the way we're designed to sort of look at things. Like, for instance, just imagine closing your eyes and imagining you in a pair of sweatpants. So
that's a permanent
sort of
paradise right there, baby. I would just like
to thank you
for piggybacking on the philosophical Friday theme. And in summation, it's going to be high 60s around the Northwest this weekend.
It's going to be beautiful.
That's all we need to know.
We're in it.
There we go. Fine. How about the fact that they found out that the reason remember the plane? It was in Auckland, New Zealand or something where all of a sudden it fell like I don't know how many feet. Apparently, the flight attendant went in to serve one of the pilots, I think in the co-pilot or the pilot seat, which one, and is the flight attendant leaned in to sort of, I guess, hand the guy a tray or whatever it was, or a cup of coffee or something, accidentally pressed a particular button, which then moved the guy's seat forward rapidly, which then caused him to push onto the yoke, and then the plane went
plunged down from the sky for a time at least.
Right. So now is this another thing against Boeing or something? Or it's like, well, that's operational error. Okay.
Well, back to this idea of utopia. I don't know what kind of world we live in where no one expects that there's going to be human error, whether it's in medicine, whether it's in flight, whether it's in people driving cars. 19th century French philosopher, sociologist, political scientist.
You know, deep into it today.
Come on. You know Alexis de Tocqueville, right?
Let's do it.
Yes, I do.
He wrote a brilliant book called Of Democracy in America. It should be on everybody's shelf. He once laid down a principle that later became known as the Tocqueville effect. Okay. It's this phenomenon in which as social conditions and opportunities improve, John, social frustration grows more quickly. It's kind of a paradox. So in other words, the appetite grows by what it feeds on. I think that principle can be applied to what we're seeing here with Boeing in recent weeks and even in recent years. Okay? Follow me on this.
Yeah.
The safety record for...
Wait, hold on. Just let me interrupt this for one second with the way we normally do the show.
I'll take the feces.
All right, thank you. All right, go ahead. Back to it. Go ahead.
The safety record for commercial airline flight in the continental United States is incredible. It's an unbelievable human achievement. There hasn't been a major crash in the continental United States in the last 15 years that resulted in fatalities. Compare that to traffic fatalities. In the year 2021, there were 43,000 people that died on the roadways in America. 43,000. And unless you were affected directly by that, most of us don't even bat an eye at that number. Yet, what are the stories that have dominated the news cycle that involve Boeing over the past couple weeks and months? Well, a door plug failure. Nobody died. Oh, a shirt got sucked out. And we're completely consumed by it. There was like a $1 billion lawsuit on the table. And then another story. Human error. Somebody hit a wrong button and a plane plunged and some people got hurt. And we're ready to like blow up the airline industry and completely like rethink it from scratch. I think that's the Tocqueville effect because it's been so safe, the safety record for the past 15 years, that even the slightest bit of danger that we perceive, we blow it way out of proportion because our expectation has been perfection in terms of airline flight safety record in the U.S.
I agree. I like the Tocqueville thing you brought in there, but the I think the two sort of contributing factors to people's reaction is one, you're 30,000 miles, 30,000 feet in the air. That's a problem. And you're not flying it. Somebody else is in charge and you're sitting there. You've paid the money, $400, and you're assuming this thing is going to, you know, take you from point A to point B, which they do. So most of the time, it's also called confirmation bias. You're in the market to buy a Toyota. You want to buy a white Toyota. So you start driving down the road. You're like, oh my God, look how many people own white Toyotas. Well, the number of people that own white Toyotas hasn't changed at all. You just become biased to it because you're looking for it. So it's confirmation bias that happens. You can do it. It's a fun experiment to do all the time. Just start to think about something and then go out and you start noticing, look at that. Everybody's walking around in a pair of sweatpants like some sort of slob. Yeah.
I knew you were never going to let me live that down the second I mentioned
only
it.
Because I am so prejudiced by what my son said once when he was 5 years old. He said, Dad, I will never wear jeans because people that wear jeans have given up. And I said, well, how about sweatpants out in public? I don't know what you didn't understand about the jeans. I was like, wow, look at Rye taking them all down. Yeah. And he never wore jeans because anybody who wears jeans has given up. And then you would never wear sweatpants out in public. And I was like, okay, fine. And I kind of live by that too. But I do have big, weird boots on, which there's a guy that listens to the show and saw me once at Safeway who said, what'd I say? I look like a pig farmer?
A pig farmer, yes. Exactly.
That's a compliment.
After you tried to steal his son's sushi.
Yeah. There you go, right there.
See those babies? Whoa, look, I didn't know they still made boots like those. Those
boots?
Are.
Oh, yeah.
That is boots. Something. If you are not live streaming this show, you are missing out on John's giant boots.
Boots. I wear them everywhere. Everybody wears them everywhere in Clee Ellum until just about the first, you know, couple of hot days where things begin to sort of tighten up, get rid of all the mud that's out here right now. So that's it for the weather and the philosophy and all the rest that goes into it. And finally, the last part of the story is that we'll get to this one. So Washington State Patrol is going to pay $1.4 million to settle a case against a trooper accused of racial bias. So it looks like they got this guy. He kind of was getting awards for pulling over a number of DUI drivers. I think it looks like I looked up. I think he's based out there in Issaquah. So they looked at the number of drivers that he pulled over, a higher propensity of drivers that were black or immigrant. And he was pulling these people over. They were blowing a 000. On the breathalyzer, then he would still have him do the field test. Then he would put him in the car and take him down and get a blood draw. And there's nothing in any of this. I think there's like four cases that all got combined together for this guy. And it certainly looks very suspicious that often he would do these field tests outside the purview of the camera, the dash camera, which normally they do all the time. So you see the thing is done properly because DUIs get challenged all the time. So this guy, it looks like they will write the check for this particular officer, and I don't know what happens to him next. Anything else in that story jump out to you?
Yeah, I don't know. It seems justified on its surface, unless there's more details that we're not privy to here. And this is an officer who's had strikes against him in the past, was placed on a list of potentially ethically compromised law enforcement officers in Kittitas County after an internal audit found he had cheated on special assignment overtime. Doesn't it sound like this person is still on the force? I guess that's the question that I'm left with in retrospect. He's had suspensions and, you know, kind of slap on the wrists. But it made me question, what does it actually take these days to be fired or let go? Or is it just second chance, third chance, fourth chance, fifth chance? What seems justified to you?
I don't listen. Well, when you write a check for $1.4 million because of the actions of the officer, it's like that guy's a liability. Do you really want to have him around?
Seems
they
like
also
it.
Caught him sort of padding. I think they said something in there whether it was that was brought up in the case, and I was in the Seattle Times. They were sort of padding some of his time, seeing sick time, and then they looked at the audited part of his paychecks. Listen, they were desperate for troopers. Whether this guy passed, you can get a bad apple in there. I like the fact that other troopers were sort of calling him out,
right,
and for some of his actions, and then taking it up to the, you know, the higher ups. Whether those guys responded to it or not, that's where the problem always starts, because those guys that are working in the field, most of them are really good about getting the bad guys and saying, listen, we don't do that. Don't do that. It gives the rest of us a bad name. Stop it. And if it doesn't stop, then they take it to you know, sergeant or somebody up the ladder. And then they're the ones supposed to do something about it. Whether they did or didn't, I don't know. But the check goes out. The most interesting part of the case I read was the defendant, the officer, and his attorney were saying, listen, if you combine all of these people together, I think there's four in the suit, it's going to, and since each one of these offenses, according to you, have happened at different times, when you put them all together, it's going to prejudice the jury to make it seem like it's happening all the time, or the volume of the number of stops. When you have four of them together, the jury's going to be like, wow, look at all these people. Is it like, who else does he do this to? And the judge looked at that. There's a bunch of different cases brought up and said, no, we'll let it stand. So I think all of them together brought the case against the trooper. So
when it sounds like there's a policy within the police force to give awards to officers that get the most DUI bookings, but whether or not the people are actually convicted didn't matter as much as just getting the quota up, or basically, or to meet a certain quota or to surpass it. And should that policy be reexamined in the long run? Maybe, because it incentivizes people to just pull over as many individuals as they can and write them up for a DUI to try to get that reward.
Right, because you hear that about the parking enforcement people. Oh, they must be on some quota. Or your state troopers pulling over people for speeding. Oh, it must be the end of the month. They're out there trying to catch everybody because they got to get a certain number. From what I've talked to troopers, they don't have an incentive like, oh, the most amount of speeding tickets, you get more money. They don't have that. But a mayor, maybe they're like, hey, you get a lot of DUI guys. You know, I don't think they give you more money, but they give me more awards or something. Mm-hmm. So
accolades.
Make it somewhat, yeah. Accolades and make it somewhat competitive. All right. Well, there we go. When's Joe, when do you have my, I got to tell the story.
Oh, yes. Next, please.
By the way, that particular story about the time I had to go to the emergency room, they called two police officers in to question me on that fateful evening.
Did you have something that lasted October. More than 4 hours? Sorry, that was a low blow. I came from Sweats Guy. Sorry.
Wow, that's a tease.
Let me ask you this. So if I had taken something less, more, why would they call the cops on me if I had taken something less than 4 hours?
How
did
you tell me?
Huh? No. Hey, it's a lethal weapon you've got there. Oh, I've only told this story one other time. Oh, by the way, welcome back. John Curley, Sherry Elliger Show. Sherry out. Greg Tomlin is in. Thank you, Greg, for doing this again. Second time in a row. You can write to us at MyNorthWest.com. Come on in through that State Roofing text line at 1-888-973. Oh, not State Roofing. I'm sorry. Muckleshoot Casino Resort text line. 1-888-973-5476. Follow us as Joe put up some video of the barn, White Barn Retreats, where I live. Not by choice, by the way. If I could have my cabin back that burned down, I would be in that in an instant. Living as lovely as it is, if you look at the video, by going to the John and Sherry Show Instagram page.
Oh, that's a tease.
Now, do you think, John, when people call it a compound, do you find that a pejorative?
Yeah, I would. Wouldn't you?
I don't know. Well, I think that's what your video said in the details
that's
of it.
That's Joe put that
yeah,
in.
Yeah, Joe. It makes it sound like he lives in Waco or something.
Right. Storing giant containers of gasoline on the seat, on the roof.
Gunfire all day.
No, I in the little cabin, it's quaint. It's nice. It was sweet. I loved it. Living in a barn, the thing is like 7,000 square feet.
Huge.
And there's not any place you can kind of like, ooh, this is a comfortable little spot to be. I read my book, my Tolstoy or something. Oh, it's as big as a giant barn. If you look at the video, we have cars parked inside. It's lovely, but it's not homey. It's like living
it's a
in a hotel.
Sure.
Yeah, it's like living in a hotel. I saw somebody wrote, must be nice to flaunt your rich something.
Your opulence, man. Get it out of my face.
Yeah. Must be nice to pay $14,000 a month for that thing. That's what it cost.
It's gorgeous. Well done. Yeah. Well done.
All right. Well, anyway, Joe wanted to hear the story. I told it once on the air in Cairo Radio. Somebody in management was like, oh, we would appreciate it if you didn't tell that one. Heard it. Move on.
Chris and Sumner specifically requested it yesterday. He
all
said,
right, Chris, for you. For you, Chris. I went on Match.com. I met this really nice person, and we went on a date, a couple of dates, like three dates. And then she lived over in Bellevue, and we went to this marijuana store. And we went in there, and neither one of us had really been involved in any of that kind of stuff. Lady behind the counter was extremely nice. They're called bud tenders. And she's like, so what do you guys want? Like, what kind of high? You want to be on the couch? What sort of the head? It's like, I don't know, whatever. She goes, well, how about this? And she brought this little bottle, and it had 30 milligrams and a little shot glass on the top of it. It was raspberry flavored or something. So we drank it. We both very careful, just little bits of it, drank it. It was really fun, had a great time. And then like a week later, I think we're out on our third date. We go back and, oh, how was that? Oh, it was really fun. Well, this is, you guys like the raspberry. This is the mango and it's on sale. I was like, oh, well, cause she'd look it up on the computer. She could see how much what you bought recently. I said, okay, well, let's do that. Pay the money, bing, bing, bang, walk out, do the little thing, take the little cap off. We fill it up and cheers. Here's to another fun date, right?
Whee!
We drink the thing. Woo! And we go to this really nice Italian restaurant over there in Bellevue. We're sitting there, and all of a sudden, we're waiting. The waiter comes over, and oh, we have this and the ravioli.
And you started speaking Italian. No,
my day goes, oh, my God, I can't feel my arms. Oh, my God.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God, I can't. Ooh, what's wrong? What's going on? I feel the same thing, but I'm trying to remain in control because, you know, one of us has to remain in some sort of control. And I'm just like, I take my phone and under the table, I go, is it possible to overdose on marijuana? It's like, and then I did it quietly. And then people do not normally overdose on marijuana. I'm like, come on! She's looking at me. I go, no, you're fine. So I quickly run into the bathroom. I call the place. I said, hi, I was just in there about an hour and a half ago. You might remember me. Yeah, we bought the mango. Yep, no, date's not going well. Having big problems. She can't feel her arms. Is there a reason she can't feel her arms? Well, I don't really understand. I mean, last time you were in here, you got the raspberry. Yep, yes, is it the flavor? Well, you got 30 milligrams 2 weeks ago, and this is 300 milligrams.
Oh, no.
Oh, boy.
We had consumed 150 milligrams.
Gosh.
Both. I didn't look at the bottle. I didn't know. And now we're driving to the hospital. And we pull up to Overlake. And I am out of my mind.
I bet.
I don't know how to stop the car. It's her car. I leave the car running in front of the emergency room, and I walk out and walk her in there, and they have a room, and I'm like, I'm not going to get a room because it's very expensive. So I just stay at the bottom of her bed, and the doctor comes in, and they put my last name like her last name. They think we're married. So the doctor comes in and says, okay, Mr. Jackson, I'm going to just check your wife. She seems to have some palpitations. She's a reaction to this. It's no big deal. And I go, oh, okay, so we're just going to, and he turns to her. He says, so we're going to put the EKG on you. And I said, okay, well, I'll step out of the room. And he goes, we're just going to put this. I go, I know, but we're kind of modest people because I've never seen her without her shirt on. And the doctor's like, well, this is sort of weird. But she's in a bra. And I'm like, oh, it's okay. I'll just wait out here. Well, that was the first sign that something wasn't right. And then the doctor comes out. Is that your wife? No. Oh, who is this? And I said, well, that's her name. Well, who are you? And with that, they got the little magic marker thing and they scratched my name off the little poster. And then half an hour later, the Bellevue Finest show up, and they take me out into the hallway.
Uh-oh.
What's the deal? I said, the deal is we consumed more than we should have, and that's the deal. Do you know her? Well, I mean, know her, not in a biblical way. I mean, but not like, I mean, what do you mean? What do you, whoa. And I'm out of my mind. But I'm like trying to remain straight. I go, wait, what are you saying? What? No. And he goes, are you also incapacitated by this? Yes. Well, why don't you get a room? I don't want to get a room. I'm going to lay down at the bottom of her bed. I don't want to pay the $8,000 for a room, so I'm just going to curl up at the bottom of her bed. And the guy's like, are you Curly from Evening Magazine? I said,
oh, boy. Oh no. Who's
will
that?
It will it help? I said, I didn't drug her. I'm just as bad. And we sat there in that room, and like every half an hour, the doctor would come in. How old are you two? I'm like, I'm like 50. I'm 59. why did you do this to yourself? I'm like, can't you give us something? Can't you give us an inject? Can't you stop this? This is horrible. And he came in and like he'd lecture us like a stepfather for 5 minutes.
Like the DARE program, the just again. Incarnate. Yeah.
Yeah. Why don't you get the guy dressed up as a dog to come in, you know, the Rex the fire dog and have him lecture us. Oh, it was awful. 12 hours.
Ugh.
12 hours laying there at the bottom of the bed. OD. I didn't OD on it, but it wasn't pleasant.
I mean, 150 milligrams.
That's a lot.
Yeah, 10 is like the standard dose. They don't even let you sell gummies that are stronger than 10 milligrams.
God, it was horrible.
The rats eating our marijuana. They're all high.
Yeah, and so it would be like eating 6 rats. That's what it would be like, the equivalent. And then they wheeled her out in a wheelchair back out to the car, and she goes, did you bring the car around? I said, I did. I brought the car around, and I have it running to kind of warm it up. Well, the heat had been on for the thing for 12 hours. It's like you could have baked an oven and baked a pizza in there. Again, and she goes, oh, my God, it's so hot. I think that's the after effects of the marijuana.
I, for one, am thankful you lived to tell the tale. A cautionary tale, in fact.
Oh, my God. Look on those bottles.
Was there another date, or was that it?
It didn't go well.
Okay.
I mean, you're watching somebody in a really unattractive bra vomiting it into a bag for like 6 hours.
And in your head, it wasn't going, Dreamweaver, I believe it can get me through the night.
Oh, good, Joe. Nice try.
Thanks.
Yeah, so that's a cautionary tale, everybody. Don't look on those bottles.
Yes, and, sir.
Those... Why that one?
It's from a Wayne's World joke.
Oh, sorry.
All right. Wow. You kids with your pop culture.
You and your references.
You and your jeans.
Sweatpants.
Let's go to Ted. Ted's over there at the... Okay, stop showing off with your... Why don't we do this? Next segment, we come back and just let you sing any song you want.
Well, let's do a sing-off.
All right,
you got to tell your fun little story.
Yes. You're right. Oh, no. Don't forget the know-it-all quiz coming up at 5:30. That's right. If you've always wanted to be on the radio and talk to Greg Tomlin, well, your dreams come true today. At 5:30, all you do is write to us at the Muckleshoot Casino Resort text line at 1-888-973-5476. Find yourself on the radio. Answering 4 simple questions that I'll be writing throughout the entire show. So they're so easy, so simple. And you get yourself a cookie, not one cookie, but Teenie's in charge of them. The whole box of
cookies.
That's right. All the cookies, Bite Me Cookies, official cookie sponsor of the John Curley, Sherry Elicker Show. And people that receive them in the mail say they are just as sweet as can be. And the memories of being on the radio linger for a long time. Luscious. And life-changing.
Very nice.
Thank you, Teenie. There we go. That's at 5:30. Let's see. By the way, all you have to do is send Joe one interesting thing about yourself. That's the only way you need to get on. Just and interesting could be anything. And we do have people that have some really interesting parts of their life, and they're willing to share some bits and pieces of it. And then Joe's like, well, no, yeah, beep, beep, beep. And then he talks to you on the phone, and then you're through. You're in, you're on, and...
So this is like when Alex Trebek goes to each contestant and they have their one shot on national television where they can say one thing about themselves. I've often wondered what my one thing would be. And I often then go, I don't think I have anything interesting that would titillate the audience in any way.
Greg, I understand you came in third in the science fair project. I
understand you have a proclivity to wear sweatpants around the house. Yeah, that's me.
Yeah, you wear sweatpants. That's right, Alex. I enjoy wearing sweatpants around the house. All right. Well, good luck to you. And then move on to the next person. They're working on cold fusion in their basement or something. Yeah, that's the having to come up with one interesting thing that Alec can ask some question about. Somebody fell into, was it Alec Trebek that got caught with the, I understand you were hoping for snow on your honeymoon. You ever seen that one?
I have seen that one, yep.
Did that really happen?
And she said, no, I didn't. Well, can I pay off the joke, or is it too obscene?
Yeah. It's a little, people get
okay,
it.
Okay.
All right.
You and I both know.
Alec Trebek walked right into that one.
Yeah, he did.
I got to Google this. I have no idea.
it's worth a Google.
Okay.
Yeah.
It is worth. Yeah. I got a quick Alex Trebek story for you. A friend of mine, John Stoffel, had a chance to, when he came to the University of Wisconsin, Stoffel was the anchor for NBC. And they did 5 shows in one day. And it was Stoffel's job to sort of keep it going in between while they're bringing the contestants on and all the rest of the stuff and they're setting up. So Alex Trebek is standing there and said, well, I'll answer questions from the audience. And Stoffel says, oh, okay, well, let's do that. It's full. I mean, it's University of Wisconsin. It's in this giant, giant auditorium. Stoffel says, it must have been like 5,000 people in there. So it's most of the people from Wisconsin that are there. They're Wisconsin people, you know, they drink beer and they like their beer and they like their cheese and they're like a Wisconsin cheese. And so this, you can imagine the type of people who are sitting there watching Alex Trebek do the show. Stoffel's running around with a microphone. You have a question? Yeah, hey, Alex, big fan. What's your favorite beer? Alex goes, well, domestic or imported? Huh? Domestic or imported? Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Well, why don't you come up with a better question?
Good old Alex.
And then someone yells out, Old Milwaukee! No, I don't care for that beer. There is a Belgian beer that I like, and it's made in a certain part of Belgium. And then another question, what's your favorite cheese? Well, again, I'll ask again, domestic or imported? Huh? It was the worst. And when somebody else asked a question, he didn't say Wisconsin cheddar. They booed him. No. You don't boo. When you boo, you're only telling everyone how ignorant you are. And with that, Stoffel said, I watched 5,000 people instantaneously hate the guy for the next 4 shows. It's like he didn't get the audience. It's like that. Just say Wisconsin cheddar. Just say Old Milwaukee beer. Don't try to be super duper fancy smart guy from Canada. Right?
God rest his soul, Alex Trebek. Jeopardy will never be the same.
Alex, I'll take how to piss off a crowd in Wisconsin for 400, please.
That's right, Canada. Suck on that.
There you go. Right there you go.